He's real.
If you say his name, or even think it, he'll come for you.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
I'm afraid of putting this into your head.
Tell me.
Bye-bye, man.
Wow. He wasn't happy or unhappy that the story he used to tell it, you know, that his story became like a movie?
No.
Weird.
No. He's a great guy. I've known him for, he's probably one of my best friends. I've known him for years. And to tell you how good a friend he is, when the contract was being negotiated, he said he didn't want any money or anything like that.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was very cool.
Yeah.
So, you know, he just signed off on it and said, I hope you make some money out of it.
Nice.
Yeah, I got great friends.
Yeah, and, you sure do.
Yeah, I do. And I think it was just one more little incident in his life. I mean, if there had been a movie where someone was playing me, I would never stop talking about it.
Yeah, he's that's what other, I mean. I'm like,
he's got
I'm,
other
I'm
things
like,
to do.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess if your life, yeah, I guess if the bye-bye man thing came out of your life, then it's probably like, I could see how you'd be like, eh, you know, I lived it, man. I don't need to see the movie.
Exactly. And it's funny, the girl who is played by that beautiful blonde woman in the film, I don't remember her name, but, something Bones or... I don't remember her name,
yeah.
But I contacted the real woman because I needed to get her to sign off on it, and she was she was perfectly happy, didn't want any money or anything like that. All she said was she didn't want to hear about it or be bothered about it again. It was an unpleasant experience for her.
Wow.
And she just didn't want anything to do with it again.
Wow.
And that was it.
Jeez,
you know,
yeah,
it was interesting. It was the only time I've ever spoken to her, and she was certainly nice enough about it, but she wanted absolutely nothing to do with it.
How much time had passed, like between when the thing happened and how old she was?
Oh gosh, I don't
roughly.
Even.
Give me
I don't. It happened in the early 1990s.
Okay, so about 20, 30?
No, nothing 20. Like that. No.
Early 90s, though.
It would have been. Well, I wrote the book. The book came out in 2005, and I wrote it during the previous 2 years, so maybe 10 years.
Oh, because you had to talk to her before you wrote the actual story.
No, I had to. I could write the story without talking to her, but the film people contacted me right after the book came out.
Oh, okay.
Maybe 6 months later.
Okay. I see.
Yeah, so say about 10 years since she had the experiences. Yeah, she had a number of strange experiences, and she liked the paranormal, but only the nice paranormal.
Yeah.
She liked
angels.
She liked angels, and she liked getting positive messages from spirits. You know, everything is love, all is one, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, God.
Well, she likes that. And she didn't like being scared by it. And when it did scare her, it really scared her. So she simply signed off on it. And she was good about it. You know, everyone was really good about it. I have no complaints, except that I'd rather not walk to the mall in the snow.
Yeah. They could have also, like, I was just thinking they could have done, like, the story, like, they could have opened and closed the movie, like, done one of those movie in a movies where they have you, where they have a character playing you writing it, and then you've been like, what the hell, dude? Gilbert Gottfried, really? Gilbert Gottfried? Like...
Oh, that would have been great. I would have liked that even more.
Anyway. Yeah, I'd hang my hat on that for the rest of my life. I'd be like, yeah, I was played in a movie by Gilbert Gottfried, okay?
That's right.
What have you done lately, bro? On Thanksgiving, yeah. Let's watch that movie where Gilbert Gottfried plays me.
Right.
Everyone's like, we've seen it 6 times, dude.
That was today.
Yeah.
The only thing is that if it does end up as a franchise and they, you know, it goes into a 2 or a 3, all I want is if there's a restaurant scene or something.
Oh, a cameo,
I want them to fly me out there, and I want to be sitting in the background with my computer writing.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. That was part of the thing where it's like if they had just talked to you, they would have put you probably in a scene. It's very annoying. I find that very, like, disenchanting.
Again, Tim, they have a different set of priorities.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I'll give you an example. Again, here is a group of people. They come together to do a project. They fly apart again.
They might never see each other again. Yeah,
These are not people who are interested in the paranormal. These are people who are interested in making movies.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I I filmed a cameo for a movie this summer that Adam Gilreilly has a starring role in, called The Hill and the Hole. That'll be out next year.
Which one are you?
I'm a short order cook, I guess you would call it. I don't know. I'm a worker at a fried dough truck.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I have one line, but I have a cat. My character's name is Tiny. And for real, yeah. And the movie, and Adam Gilreilly plays like a Freemason who's involved in all kinds of Freemasonic rituals and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's coming out next year. For real, this is really. And I was like, okay. I mean, I went to film school, so I kind of have been in my share of like student type movies and stuff. And it was, doing the whole thing was exhausting because it's a lot of work. Involved, and it's a combination of like standing around and having to do the same thing over and over again, and trying to do something different every time.
Right.
And then I saw the movie, the clip of a movie. They sent me some, like, you know, I don't know what you'd call them, dailies or whatever. You know, they edited together
the rushes.
Actually, they edited together a sizzler reel that they shared just for people who've seen who were in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality is amazing. It really is. It's outstanding. Like, I was watching it. I'm like, oh my God, I was in a real movie. Like, I thought this was just some lark thing that some guys were making. But no, this is a real movie. This is like really well done and incredibly, like, you know, it was like the kind of thing I could never do. The lighting and the camera work. It was like these are really highly skilled professionals. What have I gotten myself into?
Yeah, you see, and again, that was one of the things that I just. Was very difficult for me to understand. And that was really just like, how can you not be as fascinated by the story of the Bye-Bye Man as I am?
Mm. Oh, well.
You were fascinated by entertaining the audience.
Mm.
And I just don't get it.
Well, what got me off on that tangent was I noticed just from my brief time with the folks making the movie that it was like a little underground sort of like world that I was just getting a glimpse of.
It was a subculture.
Yes, yes. And you know, like, I think like one of the directors and one of the stars of the movie had just driven like for 2 days straight across country to get there to film the next part of the movie, and they had just rolled into town that day. And it was like other people had flown in from New Mexico, but it was a small group of like 12 or so people. And it was like, this isn't an odd, you know, and it was like, so where are you going after, you know, you're going to the thing? And it was just very, like, a very odd, like a little family, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was like, I was the interloper of this little family.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was like, wow, this is cool.
I noticed that, too. In fact, I became Facebook friends with some of the people. I became Facebook friends with some of the people who were involved in the movie just so I could find out what was happening, because no one would tell me anything. So I would go to the, they would print things like, oh, we, you know, here's the cast party, here's the filming. And so I knew what was going on. And at one point, one of them ran a picture from Thanksgiving. Well, it turns out he's related to a well-known TV star, and I think there was like a director and a producer there. They were all related.
Huh.
And so, it is a small world that you're either in or you're out. But, of course, you know, we have the exact same thing. If we had dropped one of those people into the cryptozoology convention.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
you know, for them it would have been, wow, I could make a movie about this. No, no, don't you see, these things should be living out in the woods.
Oh man, yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah. It's we have our own little world of.
Oh yeah, we do.
Of
and,
folks,
you know, we all know each other, and we all flew in from here or there.
Yeah, and then we all break up at the end. Yeah, that is exactly what it's like. Yeah.
So you know, again, it's not that much different. And then you get someone like Seth Breedlove, who is right in the middle. He's actually making movies. And he's fascinated enough by cryptozoology to make a series of movies about small-town monsters.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, it's actually, ironically enough, the folks who made The Hill in the Hole actually filmed the little video at Lauren's Museum. They're from New England. And they filmed the video.
Oh, that's great.
I think their Mandate 33 is their film company, or at least that was mm-hmm. what their sort of paranormal wing is. And, yeah, they did the little video there, because I was watching at the end, it was like, thanks to Mandate 33, and I was like, oh, that's the guys from The Hill in the Hole. So, it all comes full circle.
Yes, it does.
Well, here's another thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is, it's funny, in a way, because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure I'm right, but you wrote about, you had a chapter in one of your books about the clown, let's just say the clown craze, the clown mm-hmm. phenomenon, the clown... clowns.
Right.
God bless.
Well, I was
before the 2016 clown frenzy.
Right. Yeah. I actually started out with something very specific in mind, and that was I wanted to understand what caused the clown panic in the 1980s,
Right.
1980s. And you know, at the time, that was the big clown panic. That was it.
Yeah.
And I never expected it to start again.
It's crazy. That's the.
Oh yeah, it's been going on now for over a year.
It's one of my favorite things to. I don't know if I'm a bad person, folks, but this is one of my favorite things to have happened, like in the last like 2 or 3 years.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's been a terrible stretch of time for the human race, but clowns, killer clowns, creepy clowns are apparently a problem we face here
in this modern age. And, of course, we just had the remake of It, too.
Yeah.
So, it really interested me for a couple of reasons. First of all, the pat explanations for it, which was that it was caused by the movie It or the book It, and or that it was caused by John Wayne Gacy, the Chicago serial killer, who dressed up as a clown to do charity work. Those were the two basic explanations. And, of course, neither of them were really quite true. The book came out, I think, after the I'm going to have trouble talking too precisely about this because I wrote the book a few years ago.
Right.
I just don't have everything at
well,
my fingertips.
I'll just say this, and maybe we can pivot from there, is the I actually, God rest his soul, I knew a guy who saw one of these phantom clowns when he was a kid in the 80s. And he may have been making the story up, folks. I don't know. We were just buddies and friends, and we grew up. And I knew him for a very long time. But whatever he claims happened to him was so profound that he got a tattoo of a clown with, like, a creepy cigar, you know, like a creepy clown with a cigar. He was like, that's what the guy looked like. And to me, that was like, that's, you know, so I knew somebody that apparently claims he encountered a clown to the point that he was willing to get a tattoo over it. So apparently.
Where?
I think on his arm. I'll have to ask his friend.
No, not where did he get the tattoo. Where do you see the clown?
Oh, my God. I think at like a local, a local reservoir that was like behind his house.
Really?
Yeah.
And where was it? What state?
Massachusetts.
Oh,
and
okay.
And they used to go. It was
where,
like a short
the,
walk. You know, they'd go across the street through their neighbor's backyard, and they'd get, you know, walk through some woods, very Stand By Me-like, you know, and get to the reservoir, which is a huge, essentially a Mamie Lake, obviously. And as they were walking around, and they saw a creepy clown come down from a hill wearing in a clown outfit with a cigar.
Huh.
Yeah, isn't that? And he said it was so, like, It freaked him out so much that, like, you know, later, well later in life, a decade or whatever, you know, when he was in college or whatever, he got the clown tattoo.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
You know, when the first clown flap occurred in the 1980s, when the first national clown flap occurred in the 1980s, it was only children that saw the clown. No, not one adult saw a clown. And they did see the van. One adult did see a van that the clown was supposedly driving, and her two daughters saw the clown that was driving it. But not one adult saw them. It's interesting that somebody who saw it as a child has, you know, grew up since then and still remembers it. And obviously, it had it was a very meaningful experience for him. Again, he engraved it into his flesh.
Yeah,
that's how meaningful it was to him. So, I it really did fascinate me. I guess clowns have become something of a cliche now that they're on television, they're in the movies, they're. There was one year, I think it was a year or two ago, when I watched a YouTube video on a Halloween exposition, and it could have been almost a creepy circus. It was
right.
All clowns. So, you know, I suppose it will pass soon, but the fact that it's still going on is astonishing to me. And, you know, again, anyone who's read Mrs. Wakeman, the story that I did on clowns knows that I think it really comes out of... I think it comes out of American black culture, and I think it comes out of experiences that began with slavery, all the way back with slavery, and into the period right before the outbreak of the clowns during the Atlanta child killings. And I think they were really the impetus for the clown panic, and that the shape of the clowns comes out of, again, black folklore about the Ku Klux Klan,
right,
and the belief in things called night doctors, which were medical students that were supposed to abduct black people for use in experiments and making medicine and things like that, all of which actually goes back to some African folklore that still exists, where the belief that white people need the blood of black people to survive in Africa.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I will admit that just describing it in that way, it sounds really far-fetched, but if you read the case I make for it in the book, it does make a kind of a sense that it does come out of black folklore. So, again, if somebody is interested in clowns, I would recommend reading that chapter of the book, which is called, the name of the chapter is Ku Klux Clowns.
Yes, exactly.
So, again, it's... and I'm thinking about making it into a PowerPoint presentation, because I really do think there's some validity to the argument.
I was just gonna cut you off and say another movie,
no.
Another movie, Robert.
It wouldn't really be much of a movie. It might make a good documentary.
Yeah.
But I'm supposed to be going to now that I've attended a convention, people are asking me to attend more of them, and I'm
that's
thinking,
how it works, yeah.
Oh yeah, I'm thinking. So I've been invited to this big haunting convention in Alton, Illinois, this coming summer, and I think I might put together the presentation to give there, because. You know, I really do, like I said, I think it's an interesting explanation for where they came from, and I'm having a hard time getting it out there.
Yeah, but, I mean, do you think the modern clown, the thing that happened after you wrote the thing,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting in a sense, like I said, because you wrote about it, and it hadn't really been a thing for 30 years, right, or so, and then all of a sudden the clown thing exploded, like a new generation of clowns emerged.
Yeah.
And the weird part, though, is, you know, we talked earlier about urban legends and that kind of thing. This is like Tebowing. This is like planking. This is like it's not necessarily like some mysterious thing. It's just some goofy kids with nothing better to do jumping on sort of that that meme, and now it's sort of like melding into unstable individuals in a sense, with it, and a lot of them are carrying weapons lately.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, it is evolving, but at the same time,
the
it's
clowns
like,
in the 80s were supposed to carry weapons, too.
Right, right. I guess the point I'm trying to make is, like, that there's a certain, like, it's in the zeitgeist in a sense. Like it's we know for a fact that people are picking up on this and doing it and stuff, as opposed to before where it was like, where's this coming from? You know what I mean? It's like we know where this modern thing is coming from in a sense, because people are hearing these stories and then they get it in their crazy minds to be like, I'm gonna do that too.
Well, there's actually a word for it in folklore. Folklorists call that ostension.
Ah.
Where
I was searching for a word to sort of.
Yeah, it's an odd word, but that's the word they use to describe when something exists in folklore and people make it real.
Huh. Oh, almost like a tulpa. We've talked about that on the show before, where it's like, I think that people that can conjure sort of like, yeah, that can conjure something, they can manifest it from just the thought of it being.
Well, this isn't paranormal. This is people actually doing it.
Mm.
I mean, this is where they take an idea. Again, in this case, the urban legend of killer clowns, phantom clowns, and they dress up like it. They make it real so that they end up being photographed and videoed. And again, this is something that people do. Why they do it, I don't really know. I don't quite understand the satisfaction of it beyond the, you know, just it's fun to scare people, but obviously this has some meaning for them. And
they want to be a part
of
something, I guess.
It does carry some it is meaningful to them, and it's obviously meaningful to the culture. What that meaning is, though, that's something else.
Yeah. It's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it develops from here. Because it's been, I've been enjoying watching it. Like I said, I do love the clown, the reemergence of the clown phenomenon. It's been awesome.
Well, even back in the 80s, it was already starting to mutate.
Mm.
There were reports, I think it was from Australia, of this man who was going around with a van full of giant stuffed animals. It was a very creepy story.
Jesus.
And then there was a story from England about these men that were going around in a van, and they would grab children, ask them if they liked a certain soccer team, and if they gave the wrong answer or the right answer, they would slit their mouths up to the ear to give them like a clown-like grin.
Oh, my God.
Well, this is just urban legend.
Right, right.
But again, these were... these were mutations, I think. I think these were mutated versions of the clown story.
Mm.
That it's return to the clown, I can't explain. I don't know why it's happened. Some people actually looking at my work think that sudden attention that was being given to racism and, you know, the use of racism in politics or the accusations of racism in politics had become such a big thing that maybe that racial element in the clown story had reemerged. I think we're too close to it to tell.
Right, exactly. Yeah, for sure. But that is possible because it came during a very tense time in the country's situation, you know.
Right.
Very, yeah, in history, right before the election,
it was a long election.
Yes, yeah, exactly. People will long connect the two elements, and I think there is a connection, but we don't. It's going to be a long time before we know
right
what those were.
And again, this is I don't want anyone to think I'm getting political with this. This is just an observation. I mean, when you take a look at some of the things that were happening in politics, Donald Trump's hair, as ridiculous as this might sound, there is almost a clown-like quality to him, to his appearance.
Well, he had been drawn as a clown. Try saying that five times fast. He had been drawn as a clown many times before he was elected, before he even ran for president. So it's like
true.
There's a very... The connection was already there. So it's exactly. Like, what does this mean? Yeah, exactly. It's very...
And like all urban legends, it's probably very ambivalent. On one hand, it's an expression of hatred. On the other hand, it's an expression of love. It's very... That stuff happens in urban legends. They are very rarely neat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that might have had something to do with this, too. Again, I don't want anyone listening to this to draw some conclusion about my politics or anything like that. This is something other people looking at my work, this was a decision they made, or this was an idea they had, and I think there's some validity to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we'll just see how it plays out, folks. So, mm-hmm. You know, they're already warning about more clowns because of the movie coming out this week.
Yeah, I often wonder, though, if that really has an effect. Especially nowadays, though, when you've got these people who are working for the film company and are trying to make things happen, like these balloons that are showing up on sewer gratings.
Yeah, I saw that this week.
I mean, that sounds like a marketing campaign to me.
Yeah, because the police were like, the police posted it on their Facebook page, and they were like, to the people who are doing this, we're scared, so
right.
Stop doing it. It was a weird thing where it was like, oh, I bet the movie company worked with, like, the Philadelphia police to, like, put the balloons in. You know what
yes,
I mean?
Yes, everyone got free tickets or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, come on. It's a balloon tied to a sewer grating. Are the police really scared?
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
The Philadelphia police?
Yeah. Yeah. Those clowns, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens. I keep waiting for something else to, like, take over the spot of the clowns, but it's I think they've displaced they're kind of the stand-in for your usual paranormal topics because people are less interested in those nowadays as the world gets stranger. So,
well, keep in mind they also grew out of the satanic ritual abuse panic, and they grew out of the pedophilia panic. So, you know,
exactly,
those are also elements of it, and one of the reasons why it resonated so much with so many people. So, it's all part of it, and this is a very weird part of our culture. It's almost like this is what our culture is dreaming about, you know? Not to get too... not to get too metaphorical about it, but we have weird dreams as a culture, and this is our dream.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, no, I think for sure. Absolutely. Now, I have a request, in a sense, from one of our listeners, because he was kept mentioning the Phantom Raiders, which is like Massachusetts story, and I'm from Mass, so I've only heard... I have the books, and I looked at the story, but I figured I would have you, because... I know you don't like to do rerun stories or
oh, no. I haven't spoken about this story for years.
Good.
I just, like I said,
if it's
I just
too
don't...
deep in the If it's too deep in the ether, just let me know and we can...
No. This is just, I haven't, again, I don't have the facts at my fingertips because I wrote that so many years ago. But,
right. Feel free, if you can't remember widower's name, just be like a widower.
No,
no one's gonna complain.
I do remember the basics though, and what attracted me to the story was that it happened in 1692 in New England, when everyone else was worried about witches in Salem and Danvers. Mm. And what happened was out on Gloucester, I think in Gloucester Bay, the land by Gloucester Bay. The some of the outlying farms were being attacked by phantom raiders. They would show up, and they seemed to be a mixture of Frenchmen and Indians. At least that's what the locals called them. They said that's what they looked like. And they would shoot at them, and the locals would run off to the blockhouse to take refuge, and they would arm themselves when they went out to do farming, and they would shoot at the raiders, and the raiders supposedly would get knocked down by the bullet and then jump up again and run away. And when the raiders ran over muddy spots, they didn't leave footprints, and the incident got so much attention that they actually sent in a militia from nearby, and the militia chased them through the woods, and the militia saw them too. But they never actually hurt anyone. They never caused any damage. They never really... They were a weird combination of real and unreal, like so many paranormal things. And eventually the group just decided that they were phantoms and they weren't going to worry about it anymore. And, you know, these were not real raiders, because it was one of those times when the colony was in a real uproar. I mean, there was the witchcraft going on. There were panics going on with that.
Yeah.
And there was a fear that they were going to lose their charter. There was a very real possibility of another war with France, and also a war with the Indians. And what a lot of people don't know about those early wars between the Indians and the settlers were they were vicious, vicious wars.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, torture was common. There was King Philip's War and a bunch of those early American wars, and the people that had been through them it left a mark. I mean, they were traumatized by it. And so you put all those elements together, and suddenly having a phantom panic in Gloucester makes some sense. It was totally overshadowed by what was happening in Salem. And, you know, Cotton Mather played a little bit of a part. He's the one who told the story. And one of the main person, Ebenezer, what was his name? Oh, gosh, it went right out of my head. The main person who was involved in the story, his mother believed she had been bewitched, and he might have brought down the girls from Salem to see if they could see anyone bewitching his mother.
Oh, God.
And they did, but it doesn't seem to have turned into a trial. So it was, again, it was actually a very interesting story, and one of those things that deserves more attention than it gets.
Now, what is the story of the bullet part?
Oh, okay, yeah. The main man, again, I can't believe I forgot his name. That's just killing me. excuse me.
No worries.
He was leaving the, he was either leaving his house or he was leaving the bunkhouse, I think, which... The blockhouse was a fortified wooden cabin that the people in the neighborhood would run to in case they were attacked. And it was made out of extra thick wood, and they could defend themselves there. And they were hiding there in the blockhouse, and he had to go out for some reason, I think to get help maybe. And these phantom raiders showed up, and they shot at him. And the bullet went into, I think it was a hemlock tree, and the hemlock and this piece of wood, this branch with the bullet, was apparently saved for years and years, and it was the only physical evidence that these raiders had ever existed. It has since vanished, although someone might still have it in their attic somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. My friend Steve Ray was saying that he wanted to go find it when he came here to.
Oh,
visit
yeah.
Me.
It would be great to know if it still exists.
Am I going to go knocking on doors in Gloucester, though?
Well, it's possible. In fact, a knife that was used by this man, it still exists. It's in the local historical society. Supposedly, he killed a bear with it.
Wow.
Yeah, so this knife still exists. But as far as I know, the bullet. No one knows where the bullet is, but it would not surprise me if it still exists somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. If anything, it's like dislodged from the wood and sitting in like a little basket. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Nobody even knows.
It's sitting in someone's attic somewhere. With any luck, it's wrapped in a piece of paper explaining why it was saved.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. We hope. Yeah, we hope. Now, at the conference in Portland, you talked about the Ape Canyon incident. So
right.
I'm sure Lauren won't mind because we've already gone past, you know, the conference has come and gone. Tell us a little bit about, and you wrote about it, obviously, in one of your books.
Mm-hmm.
We've never covered it on the show. So talk about this incident and what you uncovered from it, because I was blown away, and I'm sure you had to be even more blown away, I guess, that Lauren has like a piece of the canyon or the fence or a part of the site of the incident at the museum, which is
oh,
really
wow.
amazing. Did you see that?
Well, that, to be honest, what was that?
He has like a piece of wood from the cabin.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, you didn't see that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, yeah, he has it at the museum.
Oh, I didn't see. Well, now I've got an excuse to go back.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the excuse me. The story actually grew out of two different stories that appear in The President's Vampire or The Bye-Bye Man, depending on which title you use.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was called Bribing the Dead, and the other was the story we just spoke about, The Phantom Militia, because in The Phantom Militia, I go into other stories of people who claim to be under siege by paranormal entities, if you like.
Yeah.
So I talked about the goblins that attacked the house in Kelly, mm-hmm. the Hopkinsville, Kentucky case. And I also spoke about Ape Canyon. And so that was the first time I ever wrote about Ape Canyon. And I just gave the standard version and moved on to, you know, like, so here are some other examples. And in that book, I also wrote a story called Bribing the Dead. And Bribing the Dead was about a big hoax that took place in New Jersey in the 18th century, where this man who claimed to be a sorcerer got all of these people to contribute money so that he could use his magical powers to bribe these ghosts that were guarding a buried treasure to let them have it.
Oh, my God.
What do ghosts want with money? I don't know.
Yeah.
But this is the way they thought. So I did a lot of research on magical treasure hunting, which I knew nothing about.
Mm.
I never even knew it existed. I knew about it from little things in pirate stories and from Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Gold Bug. That was it. That was all I knew. But it turned out this was something that a lot of people did for at least 60 years. And there were about three big waves of treasure hunting when it became popular throughout the United States. So this was one of them. It came after the Revolution. It went on for about 60 years. So this was not a minor thing. So while I was doing the research, I had read Fred Beck's story, the book that he wrote. And Fred Beck was one of the miners at Ape Canyon. And in 1967, he and his son Ronald put out a book called I Fought the Ape Men of Mount St. Helens. And the story begins with the story that everyone knows, and the story we just told, which was that a group of five miners were working their claim in Ape Canyon, which is very close to Mount St. Helens. They found weird giant footprints. Then they began to hear whistling, and they heard what sounded like someone pounding on their chest, and it was getting them nervous. And finally, one evening, they went out to draw water, and this ape creature, this ape man, this giant ape man, stuck its head out from behind a tree. They shot at it. It ran off in one direction. They ran off in the other direction. They returned to the cabin, and that night they were attacked by these ape creatures.
Mm.
They threw stones on the roof. They tried to knock the door down. The men inside were terrified, and they would shoot at them when they were attacking and try to drive them off. Anyway, the attack subsided in the near morning, and on their way out, they saw one of the ape men standing not too far away, and they shot him, and his body fell off a cliff. And so it was, they could never get it.
The one guy who hung around too long.
Yeah, they don't know what he was doing there. I suggest in the book he might have just been walking by and didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, he's like, oh, that's where they all went last night.
Right. He was just an innocent giant bystander.
Yeah.
But anyway, he ended up dead, and all the men ran to the car, and they drove off. And the story got out, and it became part of the local folklore the area became known as Ape Canyon. It had probably been known as Long Canyon before that, but I haven't been able to prove that. And it became a part of local folklore. Well, then the 1950s came along, and cryptozoology came along. And stories like this were studied for possible, for evidence of maybe this could tell us something about Bigfoot. Keep in mind, this had never been, it had never been scientific. That had never been an aspect of it. It was a folktale.
Right, right.
That these men said had happened to them, and it became part of folklore. But now it became part of cryptozoology, and it was being examined for evidence of how these creatures might act and all that was not, really not the most appropriate use of the story. So 1967 comes along, and the Patterson-Gimlin film had been shot, and so everyone was paying a lot of attention to Bigfoot. And Fred Beck decided that he would write his own version of what happened in 1924, which is when all this happened, and he would give his explanations for everything. He would give his version of it. Well, he published it, and it was it's a strange little book. It's only 22 pages long, and in it he describes how the men were all spiritualists, and they had used spiritualism to contact spirits that led them to the gold mine that they finally did excavate. Although they had done something to offend the spirits, so the gold, he told them that they would never have the gold, but they decided to dig anyway because they'd been looking for years. And when they finally were just on the verge of reaching the gold, the Bigfoot monsters attacked them. The ape men attacked them and drove them from their mine.
Wow.
Now, my point in telling this story was that what they told was essentially an updated version of a traditional ghost hunting story, because in traditional ghost hunting stories, what a person would do is they would hire a seer or a sorcerer of some kind to summon a spirit of the dead. The spirit of the dead would tell them where treasure could be found. They would then go to the spot with the seer or the sorcerer. The sorcerer he would draw a magic circle that would provide protection for them, and it would protect them from the guardians of the treasure. And one of the things you had to do was keep silent, or it would break the spell. And someone invariably spoke. Usually just as they were on the verge of finding the treasure, and all of these phantoms and these monsters would appear and drive them off. There were a number of parallels between Fred Beck's description of what happened at Ape Canyon and this traditional ghost hunting story. Again, it's not 100%, but there are enough parallels to make you think that part of the reason this never quite fit into cryptozoology is that it really belongs to the folklore of magical treasure hunting. And that was really what I was trying to that was my only real point, what I was trying to get to. And explain that if this story doesn't quite fit, there's a reason for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the story. Time has come and gone. Fred Beck published that pamphlet 50 years ago.
Oh wow!
His explanation for Bigfoot as a spiritual being that takes on a temporary physical body, that's since become fairly popular.
Right.
And, I think the fact that no one has managed to find Bigfoot in all that time has contributed to the popularity of Bigfoot as a paranormal phenomenon.
Oh, of course, yeah.
You know, it's just because the thing's so elusive if it actually exists. And
That's why you have all these far out theories about UFOs now, because it's like,
oh yeah,
because the aliens don't give a crap about us.
Well, I think my take on Ape Canyon is kind of an inside baseball thing for cryptozoology. You know, this is something that cryptozoologists would know about. Although I was surprised when I asked how many people in that room of 130 people had read I Fought the Ape Men of Mount St. Helens, the book written by Fred Beck. Lauren put his hand up.
Oh, and I knew Lauren would. Come on.
One other guy.
Oh, wow,
and that
yeah.
was it. So, you know, again, this is not a well-known story. But people did seem interested in it. And, it was – and I was glad of that because I get excited when I tell these stories. And, I hope that communicated to the audience.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I only saw parts of it, but my buddy who saw the whole thing was raving about it.
Oh, that's good. That's
all weekend,
good.
So.
So, I'm hoping to tell that somewhere else. I don't quite know where yet. And again, I'm thinking about making doing something with the clown story, just because that is something that so many people are aware of right now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you said you have a new book coming out on haunted houses.
No, not coming out. I haven't started it yet.
Oh, you haven't started yet.
No, I'm just writing the proposal right now. In fact,
I thought you said that was like, so it is your next book, but it's going to be, it's like Game of Thrones, the next season kind of thing.
Yeah, I think of that guy, I don't quite know why he rushes into publication the way he does.
Yeah.
I take my time with this stuff.
Yeah.
But this book, I think, will be a little quicker because it's all on one subject.
Yeah.
All my other books have been collections where I try to examine something in depth in one chapter and then move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it comes out of that Stranger Than Science approach to things where it's a, you know, you write about things that interest you. They aren't necessarily connected to each other.
Yeah.
And but this book will probably move along a little quicker because when you write those sorts of books, when you finished a chapter, you're back to square one with the next chapter.
Right, exactly. I was thinking of that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it can be a little discouraging when you're doing the writing itself because you know, oh my gosh, I'm finished. Oh my gosh, I have to start again.
Right. You know? Right. But at the same time, you don't have to like string. It seems more manageable in small bites like that.
That's exactly it. It actually is, especially the way I write, because I actually divide the story up into even smaller pieces, and you know it's that idea you can eat an elephant one bite at a time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. So how much work have you done on this? I'm trying to get like some. I'm trying to pull some nuggets here. Some teasers.
Well,
out of you. Have you done, actually, I'm interested in a sense, because I have an affinity for it, because I've been there a few times. Have you looked at the Whaley House? Is that going to be part of the book or no?
I'm not sure.
Or is it too mainstream?
No, it's not that it's too mainstream. It's this book is going to be taking a very different approach to haunted houses.
Yeah.
It is not going to be a collection of weird stories with histories explaining why this might be, and then having a psychic come in and, you know, do her bit.
Good. I'm already enthused. Yeah. Yeah, I should have known that just from talking to you tonight, where it's like the book is going to be, I hope, like a reinvention of haunted house stories in a sense. Because every haunted house story you hear nowadays is the same story.
Yeah. Frankly, it is kind of a tired genre. And there are, I can't even imagine how many haunted house titles there are out there. So I really do think this is going to be a contribution that's going to take it in a different direction and an exciting direction. And I know my publisher is happy because this is so much easier to market.
Yeah, that's what you were saying earlier, yeah.
Yeah. So I have a feeling that when it comes out I will do the entire haunting circuit. It'll probably take me at least 2 years to do, but I would imagine.
I thought you meant haunted houses and not and like these conventions because.
They're not going anywhere. I don't.
Oh
think
no,
anything.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that. I actually, this is one of those things where I have been fascinated by ghost hunters. I have attended some ghost hunts. I've been there when people have gotten wildly excited about something they saw on a monitor that everyone realized was a cobweb.
Well, it's funny you mention that because after when I said that about the circuit, it was like it kind of like a light bulb went off in my head where I was like, considering how much fun I had at the cryptozoology conference, I should go check out one of these ghost conferences because I'm sure it's also refreshing as compared to the UFO vibe that I've been at for years.
Yeah, well, again, there's something wrong with ufology. With ufology, even that word, even that term is awful. But there's just something a little.
It's
know,
just too nostalgic, retro. It's not, you know, it's very. It's long in the tooth. I think I described it to somebody. It's long in the tooth.
Maybe a person will come along who will change that, but it hasn't happened yet. And until it does. I'm not going to worry about it.
No.
And again,
it's not our problem.
No, it's really not. But the ghost thing, I find fascinating because it's the first time since the popularity of spiritualism that ordinary people have gone out looking to interact with the dead.
Mm, yeah.
And I must admit, I do find it, it's interesting on that level, but, and of course, I sometimes wonder if the people who are involved are not doing this on purpose, but are creating the phenomena as a kind of as a group psychic phenomena. It's like a group of people want something to happen, and they're making it happen.
Through
psychic phenomena, if that's even possible. But one thing that I've often wondered about is, I would like to take all these groups and get them together and say, you've been doing this now for 10 years. What do you know about ghosts now that you didn't know then? And
oh.
that's not being cynical.
No, I know. No, it's realistic.
No, I mean, it's a genuine question. It's like, when you went into this, naturally you had some preconceived ideas about what ghosts are, how they work. Everyone does.
For sure.
So after you've been doing this now for 10 years, what have you learned?
Right. Well, I liken it to sort of what I've said on the show in the past, where it's like we bemoan the lack of resources, effort, time, manpower put into this stuff, but then you look at the ghost hunting thing, and it's like there are groups of people going out every weekend around the year looking for these things. So, and we still don't. Like, shouldn't we? We've put an incredible amount of manpower into this. If you really think about it, I mean, in cities all over the country, in townships, communities, there are UFO groups that go out every weekend all the time. I mean, still, there has been no breakthrough.
Well, I think that's because if you look at it from that point of view, you're expecting a breakthrough, and that will never happen.
Mm, yeah.
It's the whatever these phenomena are, they are ongoing. They are a part of our culture and our history, and nothing much ever really changes. They just change appearance. Now that was kind of the point of the Ape Canyon story. All Ape Canyon is a traditional ghost hunting story, treasure hunting story, in which the traditional monsters are replaced by Bigfoot, and the buried treasure is replaced by a gold mine, and instead of necromancy to summon the dead, they use spiritualism.
Right.
So it's always the same thing, it's just different packaging. And I think that applies to the paranormal in general. And I think if you're going into this with the idea that you're going to have a breakthrough or you're going to understand this, you're either going to end up crazy or burned out, or both.
Yeah, for sure.
And the number of people that have gone into this who have ended up crazy, burned out, or both kind of proves it.
Right, yeah. I think I find that some of the best people I've encountered in this are kind of like, look at it where they're like, they initially think that there's nothing to it, and then they realize that there's far more to it than they could possibly imagine.
Mm-hmm. And it's a good idea to keep a sense of humor about it.
Oh, God, yes. Well, I was thinking this as we get to the end of the show, but I was thinking this because I'll give a little inside nugget to folks, since this is the last season. A lot of times when I would have guests back on the show, it was a big aspect of sort of like what made that a good interview was how many laughs we had on the program. So, I can say for sure, Robert, that as we close up in All of America in the seasonal format, I think you'll be part of the bridge to whatever we do next, because I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation and had so many laughs at you, man. And like I said earlier, you really come off as a straight shooter, and you know, you tell it like it is, and I try to be that way myself, so I can respect that in a big way. And
I look forward to being part of it.
And I'm sorry we didn't get to chat too much at the conference. You know, it's funny though, because I was saying earlier, I was so enamored with the presentations earlier in the day that I was like, I just don't want to leave this this room. Then as the day went on, I'm like, I got to get out there and see people. And that's when you went on and we kind of missed. We just our paths kept passing in a sense.
Uh huh.
Oh, but I'm glad that we got the chance to do it tonight.
Oh, me too. And like I said, I am looking forward to doing it in the future.
And I
won't be so, you know, I'm not being so mysterious about the new book because I'm trying to.
No, I didn't think you were being mysterious.
No, I don't like really talking about it until it's got a real shape.
You know, I do respect that. No, believe me, that didn't even cross my mind. You know,
oh, okay.
It's
like
fun.
I said, it's I think people are going to be really interested in this, and it's still in the fetal stage, so
it's just a gleam in your eye right now, right?
Exactly, or maybe even a gleam in the publisher's eye. I still don't know what's going to happen yet.
Yeah, exactly. But I've enjoyed the stuff that I've seen from you, and I wish we had you on earlier, but these things work out the way they do, and I think whatever incarnation this show takes on in the future, you're going to be a big part of it, I'm sure, because I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation.
Well, like I said, I'm looking forward to it, and we will never run out of things to talk about.
I have a feeling. Now, where can folks – I was confused. Where can people find more from you? Because you don't have a hub. You don't have, like, a website. You don't have a blog.
I do. It's I have a Facebook page called Historian of the Strange.
Okay.
And Historian of the Strange is probably
yeah,
of the Strange is probably the best place to find me.
She's the worst, that British lady.
I post something there every day. Usually it's old stories, weird stories, things I might want to look into.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's contemporary stuff. It's really whatever I'm interested in.
Right.
You know, it's my Facebook page. So, and people seem to like that. So that's a good place to go, Historian of the Strange.
Nice. On Facebook.
On Facebook.
All right.
And, of course, if they're interested in my books, they are on Amazon and in Barnes & Noble and things like that.
Awesome. She may go over the thing, but we can just... she didn't cut us off right at the hour mark. But anyway, thank you so much, dude. I really do appreciate it. And if you ever come back up in the area, please let me know. You know,
I will.
I will search for the Phantom Bullet with you.
Great! Yes.
In Gloucester.
Have you been up here at all?
Because I feel like you'd love Salem.
No. I visited Salem once, and I was actually hoping to write a piece on it, but I actually got overwhelmed. And I've never really sorted out everything I want to say about it.
Well, I invite many people up here, and I'll include you now on the list. If you ever want to come up, man, just come up, and you can crash at my place. It's a very nice place.
I might give you references of
people in the community who have stayed here. So, you know, I'd love to host you up here, and we'll go check out all that stuff and figure it out. Yeah, and there's a lot of cool stuff, like America's Stonehenge is only an hour away from here.
Don't be surprised if a fat man with a beard shows up at your door one day.
I require at least a couple days' notice.
Okay.
Like, get the spare bedroom ready. But, I wish we had more time to talk in Portland, but I'm glad it led to this, because this is kind of like, now I'm in my own... I don't know how you feel, like how you were kind of intimating the same thing, but it's like, now I'm kind of comfortable. I'm in my pajamas and I'm talking to you on my phone, and it's like,
yeah, it's a big difference.
Yeah, I'm not in the conference room in a hotel, so I'm kind of like, I don't mind. Believe me, I don't mind, but you know what I mean.
No, that was actually a very comfortable place.
That's true. No, that is true. Absolutely, but not as comfortable as my pajamas.
No.
Anyway, so thank you very much, and folks can find you on Facebook. But you don't have I'm confounded that you don't have like a website just to draw people to beyond Facebook.
No, not
too
really. I'm strangely private. You know.
Yeah.
It's just a peculiar thing. I like my Facebook page, and I'm not a mystery man or anything, but. I just I just do my writing and I do my Facebook page. And at this point,
do you really write at the McDonald's? Is that like?
Yeah, I write at a McDonald's if that's what's available. I wrote most of The President's Vampire in a McDonald's.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I wrote a lot of Mrs. Wakeman versus the Antichrist at a pizzeria.
Now, when you put the book out, did you thank the staff at the McDonald's? In the
if you go to the acknowledgments, I say yes. I thank them because they were all very nice to me, and they didn't care if I sat there for 4 hours. They kept refilling my soda glass, and
I knew you would. Yeah, those. Yeah, that's how I am, man. You got to respect those folks. They are salt of the earth. So.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you very much for doing the show, brother, and I'll be in touch. And if you ever
Great,
need anything,
Tim.
Please.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right, man. Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
There you go, folks. That was Robert Schneck. Amazing episode. I wish we had had him on earlier in the history of Banal of America. That was one that we dropped the ball on. Like I said, when we had Nick Redfern on, that was another guest that I was always like, oh, we should have had Nick Redfern on more. We should have built an annual episode out of around Nick Redfern. And that's kind of just talking to him just now, I feel about Robert Schneck. We had so many laughs. He's the kind of guy that would have been a good guest for a summer barbecue episode or something like that every year. So, but who knows? Whatever happens in the future with Banal of America, you just maybe be celebrating the 4th of Schneck or something in the future. So stay tuned, right? On that note, I don't know who we're going to have next week on the program. I'm pretty sure I know, but I haven't locked it in yet. It's another first-time guest. It's a huge departure for the show in a sense, but it's also someone who I'm looking forward to talking to. And someone who has a lot to offer as far as paranormal insights and just really unique life insights. And hopefully, if we can't get it next week, we'll get it the week after. But I think it's somebody who, in the future, you'll be like, oh, my God, I remember that guy. So it's going to be one of those, first-time guests. And if we can't get it done next Tuesday, hopefully we'll get it done the following Tuesday as we go through a string here of first-time guests. Folks you haven't heard, but folks you should be watching for. I'm way late to the dance on Robert Schneck. I mean, they made a movie out of one of his articles or one of his pieces. So, you know, but the guy is amazing. And thank you to Rogan and Lobo from Project Archivist who recommended way back when that I get Robert on the show. And I actually told them at the time, I have two rules. I don't have guests on that ask to come on the show, and I generally shy away from guest recommendations from, like, other hosts. So it was like, oh, no, dude, you cursed him. But it's the final season, so all rules are out the window. And I knew when I encountered him at the ICC 17 that that I was like, this is kismet, man. This is fate that we've been brought together here in Portland, Maine, and I got to get him on the show so we can talk about his research, his stories. And I loved it. I really did enjoy that conversation quite a bit. So thank you to Robert Schneck for coming on the show, and thank you to everyone for listening. Until next time, this is Tim Banal signing off.